construed as an admission, agreement with, or acceptance of any of the findings, conclusions, opinions, or viewpoints identified by BSR, nor should the implementation of any suggested reforms be taken as admission of wrongdoing. According to Intercept, Facebook and Instagram's speech policies harmful fundamental human rights of Palestinian users during a conflagration that saw heavy Israeli regime attacks on the Gaza Strip last May, according to a study commissioned by the social media site's parent company Meta. Meta's actions in May 2021 appear to have had an adverse human rights impact on the rights of Palestinian users to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, political participation, and non-discrimination, and therefore on the ability of Palestinians to share information and insights about their experiences as they occurred, says the long-awaited report, which was obtained by The Intercept in advance of its publication. Commissioned by Meta last year and conducted by the independent consultancy Business for Social Responsibility, or BSR, the report focuses on the company's censorship practices and allegations of bias during bouts of violence against Palestinian people by the Zionist regime forces last spring. Following protests over the forcible eviction of Palestinian families from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds, Israeli regime police cracked down on protesters in the West Bank and launched military airstrikes against Gaza that injured thousands of Palestinians, killing 256, including 66 children, according to the United Nations. Many Palestinians attempting to document and protest the violence using Facebook and Instagram found their post spontaneously disappeared without recourse, a phenomenon the BSR inquiry attempts to explain. Last month, over a dozen civil society and human rights groups wrote an open letter protesting Meta's delay in releasing the report, which the company had originally pledged to release in the first quarter of the year. While BSR credits Meta for taking steps to improve its policies, it further blames a lack of oversight at Meta that allowed content policy errors with significant consequences to occur. Though BSR is clear in stating that Meta harms Palestinian rights with censorship apparatus, it alone has constructed the report absolves Meta of intentional bias. Rather, BSR points to what it calls unintentional bias, instances where Meta policy and practice combined with broader external dynamics does lead to different human rights impacts on Palestinian and Arabic-speaking users, a nod to the fact that these systematic flaws are by no means limited to the events of May 2021. Meta responded to the BSR report in a document to be circulated along with the findings. Meta did not respond to Intercept's request for comment about the report by publication time. In a footnote in the response, which was also obtained by The Intercept, the company wrote, Meta's publication of this response should not be construed as an admission, agreement with, or acceptance of any of the findings, conclusions, opinions, or viewpoints identified by BSR, nor should the implementation of any suggested reforms be taken as admission of wrongdoing. According to the findings of BSR's report, Meta deleted Arabic content relating to the violence at a far greater rate than Hebrew language posts, confirming long-running complaints of disparate speech enforcement in the Palestinian conflict. The disparity, the report found, was perpetuated among posts reviewed both by human employees and automated software. The data reviewed indicated that Arabic content had greater over-enforcement, for example, erroneously removing Palestinian voice on a per-user basis, the report says. Data reviewed by BSR also showed that proactive detection rates of potentially violating Arabic content were significantly higher than proactive detection rates of potentially violating Hebrew content. BSR attributed the vastly differing treatment of Palestinian posts to the same systematic problems rights groups, whistleblowers, and researchers have all blamed for the company's past humanitarian failures, a dismal lack of expertise. Meta, a company with over $24 billion in cash reserves, lacks staff who understand other cultures, languages, and histories, and is using faulty algorithmic technology to govern speech around the world, the BSR report claimed. Not only do Palestinian users face an algorithmic screening that Israeli regime users do not, an Arabic hostile speech classifier that uses machine learning to flag potential policy violations and has no Hebrew equivalent, the report notes that the Arabic system also doesn't work well. Arabic classifiers are likely less accurate for Palestinian Arabic than other dialects, both because the dialect is less common and because the training data, which is based on assessments of human reviewers, likely reproduces the errors of human reviewers due to lack of linguistic and cultural competence, it claimed. Human employees appear to have exacerbated the lopsided effects of Meta's speech policing algorithms. Potentially violating Arabic content may not have been rooted to content reviewers who speak or understand the specific dialect of the content, the report says. It also notes that Meta didn't have enough Arabic and Hebrew-speaking staff on the hand to manage the spike in posts. Beyond Meta's failures in triaging posts about Sheikh Jarrah, BSR also points to the company's Dangerous Individuals and Organizations policy, referred to as DOI in the report, a roster of thousands of people and groups that Meta's billions of users cannot praise, support, or represent. The full list obtained and published by The Intercept last year showed that the policy focuses mostly on Muslim and West Asia entities, which critics described as a recipe for glaring ethnic and religious bias. Meta claims that it's legally compelled to censor mention of groups designated by the US regime, but legal scholars have disputed the company's interpretation of federal anti-terrorism laws. Following The Intercept's report on the list, the Brennan Center for Justice called the company's claims of legal obligation a fiction.
Palestinian land.
The deal of the century, the Trump so-called peace plan, which the Israelis and the United States of America claim will bring peace to the Middle East, but the Palestinians outright reject and say is an attack on their national identity as well as their land. I'm Robert Inlakesh, and I've come here to occupied Palestine to investigate what the so-called deal of the century means for the Palestinian people and the future of Palestine. Following the official release of the controversial plan proposed to end the Palestine-Israel conflict, an escalation of violence ensued in occupied Palestine as Israeli occupation forces brutally attacked Palestinian demonstrators, only to strengthen the resolve of the Palestinian national resistance. Being on the ground in Palestine, I lived through this round of violence, witnessing vivid scenes of brutality, racist hate crimes, and the murder of Palestinians. But before we investigate this further, we have to first look at the past to understand how things got to where they are today. The peace process between Palestinians and Israelis, as it is often referred to, was officially initiated with the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1993. When PLO leader Yasser Arafat signed the agreement with the Israelis, it was supposed to lead to the establishment of a Palestinian state and the ending of hostilities between Palestinians and Israelis. However, a Palestinian state, as well as peace in the Middle East, never came. Instead, the Oslo Accords had meant for the newly established Palestinian Authority that they had accepted an exclusively Jewish ethno-state on 78% of their historic homeland, and received nothing in return. 5 years after the signing of the Oslo Accords, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza was even more deeply entrenched, as Israeli settlements expanded on Palestinian land. The only difference on the ground, as peace talks had been ongoing, was that there had been further theft of Palestinian West Bank resources, the besiegement of Gaza, and the bombardment of the Gaza Strip. All of this whilst the Palestinian Authority, based in Ramallah, had acted to protect Israeli security interests. Then, following the second Palestinian uprising in 2000, the illegal separation wall was later built in 2002, in the West Bank, usurping approximately 10% of the territory, also collectively punishing 150 Palestinian communities who were disconnected from their lands, according to the human rights group B'Tselem. Settlements continued expanding and the further confiscation of land and resources from Palestinians ensued, with illegal religious extremist Israeli settlers seizing Palestinian homes in East Jerusalem, as well as in the West Bank, all of this being justified by the Israeli claim the Palestinian terrorists had to be subdued and Israel's security had to be protected. Now, Donald Trump's self-proclaimed roadmap to peace would essentially allow for Israel to take half of the West Bank, annexing the most fertile agricultural lands, aquifers, and prohibiting Palestinians from having an army or any real autonomy. It would also connect Palestinian Bantustans together via underground tunnels. Upon arriving in occupied Palestine, I had traveled to the village of Kafin near Tulkarm, where an unarmed 19-year-old boy named Badr was shot in the neck and killed by Israeli occupation forces for protesting against the deal of the century. Unfortunately, this was not the last funeral that I attended of young people and children who had been murdered in the West Bank. However, they all resembled each other roughly. Palestinian family members grieving, the look of disbelief on a broken mother's face, and the cries from the village for a day where the martyrdom of their brother or sister will enable a free Jerusalem al-Quds, a belief that gives meaning to the life of those martyred. Al-Quds is at the heart of every Palestinian. It is holy to both Muslim and Christian Palestinians who are currently unable to visit if they live in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, or Palestinian diaspora. The international consensus for a solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict states that East Jerusalem is to be the capital of the future Palestinian state. This, however, is not what is being allocated to the Palestinians under the Trump-Netanyahu vision. Instead, they are confining the capital of the Palestinian people to outside the separation walls of Jerusalem al-Quds. I'm standing here in Abu Dis, the proposed capital for the Palestinian people. And of course, Abu Dis here is a suburb just outside of mainland Jerusalem, Al-Quds. And what we see here in Abu Dis is the apartheid system in the West Bank at its most clearest. We see over here behind us Palestinian villages, Jerusalemites, separated from their brethren and their lands on the other side of the wall over here. People who have been separated so that they cannot see their family members, that they cannot come and farm their lands, and of course separated by this wall. If this was to be accepted as the capital of Palestine, that would mean not only would it be this little slither of land, which would not include the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds, but it means that it will be a symbol of the oppression of the Palestinian people. And for them to live like this, seeing every single day what could have been, and Jerusalem al-Quds with Masjid al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rocks in the background, is utter pain and struggle. This separation of Jerusalemite Muslims and Christians from Jerusalem al-Quds is rarely ever shown on mainstream Western television. And so, before you travel to the West Bank, one would imagine that the situation is completely different from the reality faced here. What my cameraman and I witnessed on the Palestinian side of Israel's wall was the humiliation of Palestinians on a daily basis, and a space allocated for a capital which would hardly drive tourism to a country with its depressing scenery, bringing with it a feeling of walking around in an open-air prison. Even on the other side of the wall, Palestinian homes are constantly being demolished and stolen by Israeli settlers, as Donald Trump emboldens their actions with the decree that Israel's undivided capital is to be Jerusalem al-Quds. The justification given by Israel for such disturbing realities imposed on the ground is that what has been imposed is for Israel's security. But even if that was the truth behind the occupation and violations of international law, this excuse was not accepted internationally by the court of public opinion when it came to apartheid South African whites. So why is it reasonable coming from Israeli Jews, I ask? But the issue of division isn't the only problem facing the Palestinians. There is also the problem of where the two divided peoples would live if remaining segregated, and where any viable borders could possibly exist between Palestinians and the Israelis. The issues of borders is of course made tough due to the Israeli illegal racial colonies, or settlements as they're referred to. Something that you cannot escape when you come here to the West Bank is seeing and witnessing how deeply entrenched these settlements are into the Palestinian land here. Currently, over 750,000 illegal Israeli settlers live on stolen Palestinian land, equating to a land grab of 40% of the West Bank. Due to seizure of land, Palestinians currently live in 165 disconnected islands surrounded by checkpoints, military outposts, closed military zones, and settlements. What is perhaps more disturbing, however, is the fact that one of the chief architects of what is supposed to be a peace deal, Jared Kushner, has direct ties to the funding of an illegal settlement named Beit El, with almost $100,000 that we know about. Kushner is also an open supporter of illegal settlements. Understanding that under Trump's so-called peace plan, settlements will remain in place, I traveled to occupied Al-Khalil, or Hebron as it's called, to meet with local human rights activist Issa Amro to learn more about what the situation would remain as in the heart of the illegal settler conflict zone.
Trump's plan is to make this permanent. Trump's plan is about, you know, legitimizing the settlements and legitimizing this apartheid and segregation and separation and keep me without any basic human rights. They don't want us to film their weakness and their truth. They don't want us to expose that Israel is an apartheid state, Israel is not a democracy, and Israel is not the state of law. It's the state of settlers, soldiers, and it's the state of apartheid and segregation. So the street is closed, all the shops are closed by military orders, and marked as closed shops. Look, it's marked, sealed, welded as a closed shop. It was closed first 1994 after the Ibrahim Awas massacre.
And what justification do they give? Why do they say they have to be closed? Do they give you a justification for closing it?
Always. The false justification is security. The main reason for it's about confiscation and to have the Arab free zone here. Closing the city center. It's the hub of the city, you know. It's the heart of the city. They closed it and they control it and they drive here. We are not allowed to drive. We're not allowed to drive in our own streets. Our shops are closed. Our houses became empty. They changed the names of the streets from Palestinian Arabic name to Israeli Hebrew names. The road signs are only in English and Hebrew. Israeli flags here, they are taking our identity as Palestinian identity.
And this system right here with the shops closed and everything happening, under Trump's plan, this would remain closed?
It will remain closed. They didn't touch it. They didn't talk about it.
The main entrance to the family is closed. The main road is closed. And we are using the fields to reach the house here. And the family is separated and isolated alone. And the army is occupying the roof. They have a military post on the roof. The family is not allowed to go to the roof.
Yeah.
And they are locked inside the house. And from time to time, the settlers come to the roof, throw stones, throw rocks, throw rubbish to the family without any help. Not only that, the Palestinian ambulance is not allowed to reach here without a special coordination. So you skip all the emergency cases. Mm-hmm. So you are not only sieged by the army and the soldiers, you are sieged from any kind of basic human rights.
We continued until we reached a military outpost where we were at first instructed at gunpoint to go back because Palestinians could not walk on the Jewish-only street there. So we filmed secretly as I asked the soldier present why Isa and my cameraman Hamdi were not able to walk on the road. The soldier I just engaged with refused to speak to me until I told him I was not a Palestinian, but many other soldiers had an even more negative attitude towards us, making it clear that Palestinians or any friends of Palestinians were not welcome. After witnessing the situation in Al Khalil, I then traveled to Ramallah in order to take part in protests rejecting the deal of the century. At this protest you're seeing alone, tens of protesters were shot and many others gassed, causing them to collapse and convulse.
We have an attack here on a member of the press, clearly marked as press. It's of course a violation of international law, firing tear gas everywhere. He passed out unconscious. This man is marked as a press and of course is not protesting. He's here to document purely, and he was targeted by the Israelis.
After the demonstration, we found out following a visit to the Ramallah hospital that four young boys were shot with internationally banned bullets. Three were hit in the legs and one in the head. The protests I witnessed, however, were just the tip of the iceberg. Other demonstrations were much more violent and led to the deaths of several young Palestinians. To find out more about why Palestinian people broke out into mass protest against the deal of the century, I met with the world-renowned journalist Jana Jihad and Palestinian icon Ahed Tamimi, both locals to the village of Nabi Saleh.
So since the announcement of the so-called
first asking Jana what she had witnessed since the announcement of the Trump plan.
As you said, are getting killed, people are getting arrested. I'm facing checkpoints on my way to school every day. Like for example, yesterday I was just going to my school and then there was this checkpoint. You know, the checkpoints here in the West Bank are not checkpoints. They're just a gate on the street. They usually close it, block the street, and then they go. They don't check the car, they just block it. So, like, I had to take another way that takes me about triple the time to get to my school. I was late to my school. Even today, we were stuck for 2 hours on the checkpoint. Every day since the deal of the century had been declared, you know, people, there are a lot of clashes, people are getting killed, people are getting injured, and it's very sad that we are paying the price of something that we didn't cause.
What we heard from Donald Trump was that when this deal was initially announced, that there would be some sort of peace that would come out of this, and that
the Palestinians would receive a great amount of money.
I believe that legalizing what's illegal is not peace. Legalizing occupation, legalizing settlements, it's not what we call peace. And I don't care about money. I just want my land. I want to stay in my house. I want to go to the sea that I've never been to, which is only 30 minutes far from my house, that I can literally see every single morning from the roof of my house that I've never been to. That's what I call peace, but that's not peace. And I don't care about money. What if I came and told you I want half of America? I'd pay you, but I just want half of America. Like, what would you do? You would just leave your houses for money, leave your land, leave your life, your memories, your history for money?
In Ramallah, I witnessed the largest demonstration the city had seen since the time of the Second Intifada, or uprising as it is known in English. What was clear to me in the West Bank was that there was a growing sense of desperation and also unity from the Palestinian people that could be felt building day by day. The desperation for action coming from the threat immediately posed to annex areas such as the Jordan Valley, which is where I began to travel to next.
So we've just entered the Jordan Valley here, and what we witnessed just as we were entering was the closed military zones here, and the soldiers in the fields actually aiming just above children and telling them to duck, using them sort of as firing practice. And then what we also discovered as we were driving along is that two Bedouin children, young children who were riding on donkeys, were also arrested by the army.
The Jordan Valley is home to 70,000 Palestinians, yet is 85% inaccessible to its people, as Israel has turned the land into a military training ground and allowed for illegal settlers to come in and make goods to sell around the world. The area is, under international law, recognized as Palestinian land, which is to be the future agricultural hub of Palestine. Its undeveloped areas could also be used for energy projects, water extraction, and urban centers.
One of the most important things to understand about the Jordan Valley is that this land here constitutes 30% of the West Bank, and of course means the loss of the most fertile agricultural land for a potential future Palestinian state. What you can see straight away when you come here to the Jordan Valley is that the people primarily here are building their houses as tents and as sort of cave structures and things like this, because the Israelis don't allow them here in Area C to actually build, have the permits to build homes. So if they were to actually build proper homes already before the land being annexed, and of course these people inevitably being expelled, then their homes would be bulldozed.
The conditions that have been imposed in the plan says that there is no Palestinian state. So what will happen with us? We are here more than 50% of the population. Now every year they demolish about 500 houses there. This plan says no Palestinian state and no sovereignty, no borders, no water, no air, no underground. Nothing for the Palestinians. In Jordan Valley, we are 70,000 Palestinians, and and the Israeli settlers are only 8,000. So we have to stay, and our existence there will be the main factor to stop the century plan.
It was clear from even before U.S. President Donald Trump, alongside Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu, announced the details of the plan, that the Israeli regime sought to annex the Jordan Valley, northern Dead Sea, and illegal settlements, throwing away all the progress of work done since 1988 between Palestinians and Israelis. Looking on at the situation on the ground in Palestine, it was clear that a two-state solution looked impossible, and that a one-state solution where Palestinians could live with equal rights to Israelis was a long way from coming to fruition. However, the younger generation of Palestinians served as a great source of hope that one day liberation could perhaps be in sight, and that the failure of the old is now being replaced by a new vision for peace coming from the young.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Heat waves have become an unavoidable health hazard for many nations, but new data indicates that they are set to affect virtually every child on Earth by 2050, the UN's Children's Fund, UNICEF, has warned. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote, at least 559 million children worldwide are already exposed to frequent heat waves, a number that could hit 2.2 billion by 2050, according to a United Nations report published recently. The UN Children's Fund publication, The Coldest Year of the Rest of Their Lives, Protecting Children from the Escalating Impacts of Heat Waves, comes as governments that support the Paris Climate Agreement prepare for the COP27 summit in Egypt. Noting the November summit, the report calls on world leaders to reduce the threat of heat waves or any period of at least 3 consecutive days when the maximum temperature is in the top 10% of the local 50-day average by ambitiously increasing action to limit global temperature rise. In addition to high frequency, an average of 4.5 or more heat waves per year, the report warns of the rising threat of extreme high temperatures, or at least 83.54 days that top 35 degrees Celsius, as well as events that are high in duration, meaning they last 4.7 days or longer, and severity, which is when the temperatures are 2 degrees Celsius or more above the local 15-day average. At least 624 million children are currently exposed to one of the other 3 high heat measures, a scenario that UNICEF says will worsen over the next 3 decades. The mercury is rising and so are the impacts on children, said Catherine Russell, UNICEF's executive director, in a statement, adding, already 1 in 3 children live in countries that face extreme high temperatures, and almost 1 in 4 children are exposed to high heat wave frequency, and it is only going to get worse. She continued, more children will be impacted by longer, hotter, and more frequent heat waves over the next 30 years, threatening their health and well-being. How devastating these changes will be depends on the actions we take now. While Paris Agreement parties aim to limit global temperature rise this century to 1.5 degrees Celsius compared with pre-industrial levels, the UNICEF report examines the heat risks for children under two scenarios for average warming by 2050, increases of 1.7 degrees Celsius and 2.4 degrees Celsius. Children in northern regions will face the most dramatic increases in high heat wave severity, while by 2050, nearly half of all children in Africa and Asia will face sustained exposure to extreme high temperatures, the document restates, highlighting that almost every country is experiencing changing heat waves. As the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs and the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies pointed out earlier this month, in addition to children, agricultural workers, casual laborers, the elderly, migrants, and pregnant and breastfeeding people face a higher risk of illness and death from rising temperatures. The groups noted that projected future death rates from extreme heat are staggeringly high, comparable in magnitude by the end of the century to all cancers or all infectious diseases, and staggeringly unequal, with people in poorer countries seeing far greater levels of increase. Given the dangers, the UNICEF report stresses that going into COP27, governments must protect children from climate devastation by adapting social services, prepare children to live in a climate-changed world, prioritize children and young people in climate finance and resources, and prevent a climate catastrophe by drastically reducing greenhouse gas emissions and keep 1.5 degrees Celsius alive. Echoing the document's call to action, Russell said that at a minimum, government must urgently limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius and double adaptation funding by 2025. This is the only way to save children's lives and futures and the future of the planet. The new publication was produced in collaboration with the Data for Children Collaborative and launched in partnership with Vanessa Nakate, a Ugandan youth climate leader and UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador, and the Africa-based Rise Up movement she founded. Nakate said the climate shocks of 2022 provided a strong wake-up call about the increasing danger hurtling towards us. Heat waves are a clear example. As hot as this year has been in almost every corner of the world, it will likely be the coldest year of the rest of our lives. The dial is being turned up on our planet, and yet our world leaders haven't begun to sweat. The only option is for us to continue to turn up the heat on them to correct the course we are on, she argued. World leaders must do this at COP27 for children everywhere, but especially the most vulnerable children in the most affected places. Nakate warned, unless they take action, this report makes it clear that heat waves will become even harsher than they are already destined to be. Guardian also wrote, the climate crisis is also a children's rights crisis. One in four children globally are already affected by the climate emergency, and by 2050, virtually every child in every region will face more frequent heat waves, according to a new UNICEF report. For hundreds of millions of children, heat waves will also last longer and be more extreme, increasing the threat of death, disease, hunger, and forced migration. The findings come less than a fortnight before the COP27 UN climate talks get underway in Egypt, and after a catastrophic year of extreme events, heat waves, storms, floods, fires, and droughts have demonstrated the speed and magnitude of the climate breakdown facing the planet. According to UNICEF, 559 million children currently endure at least 4 to 5 dangerous heat waves annually, but the number will quadruple to 2 billion by 2050, even if global heating is curtailed to 1.7 degrees, currently the best-case scenario on the table. In the worst-case scenario, a 2.4-degree rise caused by burning too many fossil fuels for too long, an estimated 94% of children will be exposed to prolonged heat waves lasting at least 4.7 days by 2050, compared with 1 in 4 children right now. In this climate nightmare, only small areas of South America, Central Africa, Oceania, and Asia will escape dangerously long hot spells. Children and infants are less able to regulate their body temperature, making them more vulnerable to the pervasive impacts of extreme and prolonged heat than adults. This includes a myriad of health problems such as asthma, cardiovascular diseases, and even death. Additionally, as intense that exacerbates drought, it can also reduce access to food and water, which can stunt development and increase exposure to violence and conflict if families are forced to migrate. Studies have also shown that extreme heat negatively affects children's concentration and learning abilities. The hotter the planet gets, the more catastrophic the consequences. UNICEF researchers examined the potential exposure to 3 heat measures, including duration, severity, and frequency, based on 2 greenhouse gas scenarios used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for climate models. They found in 2020 there were around 740 million children in 23 countries where temperatures topped 35 degrees Celsius on at least 84 days. Under the worst-case scenario, this will rise to 816 million children living in 36 countries, mostly in Asia and Africa. In such heat, day-to-day activities like play and school are compromised, and more children fall sick or die. Children in Europe will have the highest exposure to severe heat waves by 2050, 1 in 3 in the best-case scenario, 2 in 3 in the worst-case scenario. In the Americas, exposure to severe heat waves will rise fivefold from 13 million to 62 million children in 2050. By 2050, 5 million to 8 million children will be exposed to all 3 high heat measures compared with none in 2020.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tehran has once again rejected baseless accusations about Iranian-made drones being used in the Ukraine war. The Islamic Republic's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, has clearly stated that Tehran would not remain indifferent if it is proven that Iranian drones are being used in the war in Ukraine against people. The top Iranian diplomat had previously stated that Tehran and Moscow have defensive cooperation, saying it's not Iran's policy to provide Russia with weapons and drones to be used in Ukraine. Tehran has time and again clearly stated its opposition to war and any escalation of conflict, urging self-restraint on both sides. Iranian officials say the allegations leveled against the country stem from an ongoing Western campaign to pressure the Islamic Republic. Russian officials have echoed similar remarks.
Everything that is now being done on the Iranian track is subordinated to one goal, pressure on this country. And Washington is mobilizing NATO and EU countries for this in support of its position.
Also, the US, EU, and UK have moved to impose sanctions on Iran over the baseless accusations, supporting the notion that the West only wants to put more pressure on Iran. Meanwhile, Britain, France, and Germany have called on the UN to investigate the allegation. But Iran's ambassador to the UN has described the possible probe as illegal within the framework of Resolution 2231. In a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antony Guterres, Amir Saeedi Rabbani argued that the UN arms embargo on Iran mentioned in the resolution has expired in 2020, saying this means no Iranian sale or transfer of weapons or related materials to other countries is ever since subject to the resolution. The Iranian diplomat also urged the international body not to act based on the anti-Iran allegations by Western countries. Meanwhile, Russia had described the claims by the Western states as conspiracy theories, warning the UN against conducting a probe into such allegations.
No arms transfers in violation of Resolution 2231 have been ever conducted by Iran, and no drones were supplied by Iran to Russia for the use in the conflict in Ukraine.
Moscow has warned that it would reassess its cooperation with the world body if it carries out an investigation into the origins of the drones. Tehran has dismissed accusations by some Western countries and their media outlets that it provided weapons, including drones, to Russia for deployment against Ukraine. Iran's foreign ministry has called the allegations unfounded and made on the basis of misinformation and ill-intentioned presumptions. The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July, with U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleging that Washington had received information indicating that the Islamic Republic was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred drones, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline for use in the war in Ukraine. However, the Pentagon said it could not confirm the transfer of any Iranian weaponry to Russia. Since the very beginning, Iran rejected the claims, with the country's foreign ministry stating Tehran's preparedness to hold dialogue with Ukraine towards nullification of the allegations. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has even proposed a joint meeting between Iranian and Ukrainian military personnel and experts to review battlefield evidence of Iranian drones used by Russia in Ukraine. Despite that, Kyiv and its allies repeated the baseless American narrative without providing any evidence. The US, EU, and UK imposed sanctions against the country. So, if Kyiv and the West are so sure, then why are they reluctant to provide detailed evidence that supports their claims? Plus, while Iran has managed to advance its defensive capabilities despite US sanctions, is Washington using Ukraine as a false pretext to bring the Europeans along in a bid to impose an arms embargo against Iran to hamper the country's progress in the defense sector?
Iran has witnessed a deadly terrorist attack. The carnage happened at a holy shrine in the south-central city of Shiraz in Fars province. It left over a dozen people dead, including women and children. Over two dozen people were also injured in the attack. The bloodbath happened at the Shah Cheragh Shrine, which is one of the popular pilgrimage sites in Iran. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility. The gunman shot his way into the shrine through one of the entrances. He then headed to the main compound, where he opened fire at pilgrims and staff. Eyewitnesses have told reporters that loud screams were heard in the women's section of the shrine at prayer time, when suddenly an armed man was spotted with a Kalashnikov firing indiscriminately in the compound of the shrine. Officials say the perpetrator is a non-Iranian national who has been arrested. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei, has issued a statement on the incidents, saying that strong action must be taken to identify and tackle the root causes of such heinous crimes. The leader said that all people and entities in the country are responsible in the face of seditious acts by the enemy and their traitorous or ignorant stooges. He advised everyone to stay united against those undermining the people's security and disrespecting their sanctities. Iran says the attack is part of a larger plot to destabilize the country. Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian says that Tehran has reliable information that shows that terrorists and foreign meddlers have created a multi-layered scheme to make the country insecure. He says this latest attack has unraveled the sinister intentions of those promoting terror and violence in Iran. Earlier, President Ebrahim Raisi expressed his condolences to the families of the pilgrims who were killed or injured in the attack.
These riots paved the way for terrorist attacks. They came to Shah Cheragh Mausoleum and sprayed with bullets innocent people who were worshipping God. The ground for such terrorist attacks was prepared by riots.
The carnage in Iran has sparked a wave of condemnation. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has strongly censored the attack and called for bringing the perpetrators to justice. Syrian Foreign Ministry has called the mass shooting a cowardly act, while blaming the U.S. for using terror attacks as a tool to coerce nations into submission. Russia and China have also condemned the carnage. And Pakistan's Foreign Office spokesperson and the Speaker of the National Assembly have condemned the attack, saying the people of Pakistan share the grief of the Iranian nation. Sayyid Ammar al-Hakim, the head of Iraq's National Wisdom Coalition, also decried the attack. Iranian officials say the terrorist attack has revealed the actual extent of the enemy's cruelty. It comes against the backdrop of the latest foreign-backed riots, which erupted after a young woman, Mahsa Amini, died in the hospital 3 days after she collapsed in police custody. Iran has denounced the silence of human rights organizations on the terrorist crime in Shiraz. It says the terrorists based in the U.S. and Europe enjoy unwavering backing there, and Western countries refuse to publicly condemn terrorist incidents inside of Iran.
After 20 years of American deployment in Africa, the Pentagon has admitted that the area is getting worse. The Pentagon says the security environment has deteriorated and that violence has expanded in intensity and geographic reach. A report from the Pentagon's Africa Center for Strategic Studies has shown that militant attacks increased by 300% in Africa over the past decade. Violent events linked to militant groups have doubled since 2019. More than 6,200 violent events were attributed to terrorist groups in 2022, a 21% increase from the previous year. Almost 15,000 deaths were linked to the increase in terrorist-related activity. The West Sahel region and Somalia were the militancy hotspots where nearly 95% of the attacks had been carried out since 2019. Extremist groups affiliated with Daesh and Al-Qaeda militants, such as Al-Shabaab, are mainly responsible for the attacks. In this regard, the Pentagon's African Command, or AFRICOM, whose area of responsibility covers all of Africa except Egypt, describes the duties of the force as promoting regional security, stability, and prosperity, while assisting to strengthen the security forces of allied nations. But it also admits AFRICOM will work to advance U.S. national interests on the continent. Both Somalia and the Sahel are actively hosting U.S. troops, and the U.S. now has some 30 military bases scattered across Africa. Former U.S. President Donald Trump had ordered the military to pull out all its troops from Africa. However, the incumbent ordered the U.S. military to maintain a permanent presence in Africa. Last year, U.S. President Joe Biden authorized the deployment of hundreds of American troops to reestablish a persistent U.S. military presence. The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported. Also, Washington does not have a good track record, even when it comes to delivering on its stated claims of fighting terrorism. Somalia is a perfect example of systematic American military failures across the continent. After two decades of deployments, drone strikes, and commando raids to fight al-Shabaab terrorists in the country, the militant group has proven resilient and is still able to carry out attacks in the country as well as neighboring states. History has shown that the U.S. has brought instability and conflict to any region it has established a military foothold. Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Libya have all been subject to U.S. interventions and are experiencing chaos as a result. In recent years, there has been growing recognition of the militarization of U.S. foreign policy in Africa, especially following the establishment of the Africa Command in 2007. Despite its years-long military presence in Africa, the U.S. has not only failed to combat extremists and terrorists, but has also been involved in coups and the overthrow of several governments. Since 2008, U.S.-trained African military officers have attempted at least 9 coups in 5 Western African countries. According to a report, 8 such coups, which took place in Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, and Mauritania in different years, were successful. The failed coup was in Gambia in 2014. Confirmation is reported from the U.S. Africa Command that several African military leaders who staged coups in their countries participated in AFRICOM's flintlock exercises. Since 2015, 5 coups have been carried out by military leaders who had previously participated in Special Operations Command Africa flintlock exercises. The U.S. Department of Defense claims that these exercises, which were first conducted in Africa in 2005, are intended to strengthen the capacity of African countries to fight terrorism. But are they? Despite their claims, Americans have only been harbingers of more coups and more instability in Africa.
China seems to be going through a decisive change towards a one-man ruling system after several decades of power shifting. President Xi also has total control over the Politburo that he introduced among his closest allies. His power even extends to the military, as he also holds the title of Chairman of the Central Military Commission. In his most recent address to the CCP, President Xi pledged to pursue a very communist idea. He pledged to redistribute wealth to reduce inequality, as well as full employment. He also added promotion of gender equality, expansion of social security and healthcare, protecting the environment, and fighting the cancer of corruption as other items on his agenda. Despite the controversies that mainstream media tried to bring Xi into, China's current and future leader has been able to put the nation on a fast track to dethroning the U.S. as the world's number one superpower. But the U.S. isn't the only country that isn't enjoying the shift of power from west to the east. Josep Borrell, the representative of the European Union, whose recent mildly racist / elitist comments stirred emotions.
Yes, Europe is a garden. We have built a garden. Everything. The rest of the world, and you know very well, Federica, is not exactly a garden. The rest of the world, most of the rest of the world, is a jungle. And the jungle could invade the garden. And the gardeners should take care of it.
Has admitted to the role that China and Russia have played in his garden's prosperity. He said, "I think that the Chinese workers with their low salaries have done much better and much more to contain inflation than all the central banks together." He also said, "Our prosperity was based on China and Russia, energy and market. Clearly today, we have to find new ways for energy from inside the European Union, as much as we can, because we should not change one dependency for another."
This is not the first time that Ursula von der Leyen makes inflammatory or accusatory comments about China or Russia. She does still recognize the crucial role that China plays in European economy, though. In the follow-up of the EU-China summit that took place in late June, she said that the EU-China relationship is simultaneously, quote, one of the most strategically important and one of the most challenging. Regardless of what the EU or the US or the mainstream media says about Xi Jinping